I'm Will Chamberlain.
I'm Emma Waters.
I'm Ben Weingarten.
I'm Ina Stepman.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, we got plenty of action today. First, I'll be talking about the encampments all over the country, the pro-Hamas encampments at Ivy League universities and elsewhere. Inez, we'll talking about how various states and organizations are launching a lawsuit against President Biden's Title IX revisions. Ben will talk about how the speech police are striking back. And then Emma, joining us on a special occasion, will talk about how Trump and DeSantis are burying the hatchet. So first, it's me talking about the Ivy League encampment. So obviously, these have been dominating the news, both on Twitter and elsewhere. We have a pro-Hamas encampments, first having sprouted up at Columbia, now sprouting up all over the country on the property of university campuses. And, you know, these encampments are the peace and love encampments of the 1960s. They are places where people are preaching, you know, having violent slogans and then being violent towards anybody who tries to enter them, who they don't see as being politically aligned with them. There are videos from UCLA and a variety of other places, City University of New York, where people holding, you know, an American flag or an Israeli flag, or people holding, you know, even with something like the Star of David on a necklace, try to walk in the vicinity of an encampment and are either are blocked from doing so by students with security present. That was a UCLA video. Are pushed or shoved, sometimes some even punched. And the universities themselves seem to, if they're not in states run by Republicans and aren't Republican public universities, these universities seem to struggle with the basic concept of how to administer their campuses, even though they hire and employ hundreds of administrators themselves. As Governor DeSantis said, this is all just a matter of will. The universities do not have to tolerate people sleeping and setting up tents on their public lawns that are supposed to be accessible to the broader student population. And moreover, I think there, I've been listening to a very good podcast by Israelis who, I think mostly Israelis with of American descent, Call Me Back by Dan Senor. And, you know, they had a good one where they made a point that what is being said is different in English and in Arabic, right? When they talk about, for example, one of the chants, Palestine will be free from the river to the sea. Obviously, there's a connotation there that they want Israel gone. But when the chant is in Arabic, it becomes even more clear what it is they're trying to accomplish. Palestina Arabia, which doesn't mean Palestine will be free. It means Palestine will be Arab. And that means they, you know, at the most generous of that is that they merely intend to subjugate the Jewish population of Israel. The nastier and more uncharitable interpretation of that is something you could think of for yourself. But generally, there's nothing to support in these encampments. Really, it's an embarrassment to the universities that they continue. That said, I don't think, you know, the Israel issue is a fault line within the Democratic Party. There is a huge younger progressive contingent that just despises Israel. And then the traditional Democratic establishment is generally broadly pro-Israel, even if they don't like Bibi Netanyahu. And so I don't see, for my personal selfish political reasons, I'd be perfectly happy to see these encampments continue for months on end. The universities are embarrassing themselves by their inability to police what's happening on their campus. It is highlighting the fracture and the tension ultimately within the Democratic Party. And I think what all Republicans should do is at least on universities that they're directly responsible for, things like, you know, Greg Abbott's responsible for what happens at UT Austin. Ron DeSantis is responsible for what happens in the University of Florida. Where Republicans are directly responsible, they should put down the mob if they're violating student policies, and they're doing so. But otherwise, you know, Republicans there's no need to pass new laws at the federal level, and Republicans shouldn't join with Democrats to pass some new hate speech law. There's no need for that. The problem is not the lack of laws on the books. All of these students are trespassing. All of these students are violating university policy. And if the universities themselves are unwilling to enforce their policies, then let them breach their contracts with their students. Let them pay out money in class action lawsuits, and don't lift a finger to help them. Don't interrupt your enemy while they're making a severe mistake. And I believe firmly that these universities run by our adversaries in the first instance are making a huge mistake by not dealing with these violent and, harassing protesters on their campus. But I'm curious what you all think and what the proper response of conservatives should be.
Yeah, I totally agree with Will that it's a matter of will, not to make a joke about your name, but It's completely a matter of will here, both on the part of university administrators and then on the part of elected officials in terms of how universities behave at large. I totally agree with Will that there are things we should do and things that we shouldn't do. Appointing anti-Semitism hall monitors in universities is an absurd solution and completely unlikely to be effective, especially given the fact that this ideology, I mean, the anti-Semitism and hatred of Israel is only one piece of it, right? They also hate America. They also think white Americans are oppressing, people of color in America. Like the hierarchies of oppression are not limited to Jews and Israel, and the anti-colonial mentality is not limited. I mean, they think America is a colonial genocidal state as well. So, and they're very clear about that. I mean, all the chants, you listen to any of these interviews with the protesters and so on, it's really clear that this is a cohesive ideology. It's an anti-Western ideology. So the idea that appointing little hall monitors to watch out for, and argue about what's anti-Israel and what's anti-Semitism, it seems like a total disaster of a non-solution to me. What we should be doing is taking this moment to point out the fact that universities are completely dependent on federal funds, on federally backed loans, 93% of which are issued and held by the Department of Education. They are dependent now on a lot of their students who can't pay back their loans getting loans and getting forgiveness from the American taxpayer. And they have billions and billions of dollars in grants. Okay, most universities, 99% of universities, could not easily survive the hole in their budget, whether they're public or private officially, blown by if the federal government decided that they're ineligible for federal funds. All right. That's just a reality. They're dependent on us. We are paying for this. And that's a reality that Republicans and conservatives should be pointing out over and over and over again. Do you want to be paying for this? Because we are. And those are the kind of solutions that we should be looking at, is whether universities really deserve the special treatment, the tax carve-outs, right, the massive grants, the federally backed loans, whether universities, as you see, that are tolerating this kind of behavior, because the reason that they're between a rock and a hard place is this behavior is the natural extension of the ideology that they have been teaching in the classes that are now canceled. For decades, there is seamless, right? That's why you see a lot of the professors out there with the students. This is not an aberration that is different from what's normally going on campus. It's just the most public sort of visible bubble of it that is now being paid attention to by the press. So that's the sort of thing we should be pointing out. We absolutely should not be doing nothing, but what we shouldn't be doing is bailing university administrations out of the difficult decisions that they have to make now about whether or not to allow these kinds of encampments to continue that are disrupting their classes and the proceedings of the universities. We shouldn't be bailing them out, sending the National Guard, any of that stuff, right? Instead, we should be holding hearings as to whether or not we should be funding this. Yeah, I mean, that's my two cents. Just to reiterate what I said, I know I didn't have a great connection last week, but don't be afraid of these protesters. The reason to be concerned about these protests are the fact that this is the 10th or 12th year of these radicals being graduated from our elite institutions into Fortune 500 companies, right? Into the DOJ, into the State Department, into the Biden administration, right? That's what you should be worried about. That's the danger of these protesters, is what they're able to do. They're, it's the Chesa Boudin route of going in and actually acquiring power that we ought to be worried about. We ought not to be worried about these protesters in a very physical way. Yes, there have been a couple of assault incidents. Most of those have been people hitting each other with flags, right? Mostly from the pro-Palestine side. Nasty names, definitely blatantly anti-Semitic, chants. And I'm not saying any of that is fun, but the calls for Jewish students to stay home in their dorms, I don't know. I disagree with that entire defensive crouch. These are not, I've seen the Columbia protesters, NYU protesters, these people are not people who should be physically intimidating. Yes, bring your friends. Don't, sort of go at it alone with a mob. That's never a good idea. But don't be intimidated by these people physically. They don't deserve it. You shouldn't take one step out of your normal route for any of these people, is my two cents on it. But there's plenty that can be done on the political level on the lawsuit level, we should be doing all of that, but we should not be sending the National Guard and we should not be cowering.
Yeah, hopping in on what Inez is saying too, I think it's really important to remember that a lot of these students were accepted on the grounds of their former political activism in high school or in taking gap years and in even winning scholarships when they were at the university for this. So in many ways, this is exactly what the university has asked for. This is what they've selected for, especially among their minority students. And so I think we should have no sympathy for the universities, but we should, I think, really celebrate, going back to Will's point, how this is making a lot of Christian universities and other universities who have stepped away from federal funding look so good. So for example, Hillsdale College has even been fundraising on and had Babylon Bee posts written about how they've had none of these protests going on. Their students are still sane. They're doing good work. Union University, a Baptist seminary in Tennessee, has also publicly denounced these protests. And for a lot of parents, and especially for a lot of donors, this is a massive opportunity for them to really shift their funds to schools that clearly hold their pro-America, pro-good education beliefs in the system. So I think that's just been a really positive thing that we've seen coming out of this.
Well, it's worth reiterating this point that it is a matter of will, not capability, that the purported leaders of these schools are acting in such a disgraceful manner that they would turn them over to a pro-Hamas, radicals, Jew haters, Israel haters, haters of America. And it's worth emphasizing also, again, that this is the feature, not a bug, of the modern academy. And that is why you have the faculty out there. And that is in part why you have the leader, so-called leaders, cowering, because this is a problem of their making. This was the obvious outcome of left-wing administrators, left-wing leaders, left-wing faculty seeking to cultivate an environment for left-wing radicals that have always predominated, particularly on the elite campuses. But I would note that there's one other aspect of this that we haven't touched on, which is just foreign funding, foreign students and foreign funding from hostile regimes. That is a huge factor that explains in part the greed aspect of this for these schools. And Neetu Arnold and some others have done really pioneering work on this, showing the increasing percentages of foreign students at elite schools, foreign students who overwhelmingly pay full freight, full tuition, as well as foreign regimes that have flooded hundreds of millions of dollars into our quote unquote elite universities. And if you do the follow the money analysis, it's very clear that there's a corrupting influence there. Two other points I would make briefly are, one, that yes, there are dupes and useful idiots out there, but what is going on in terms of the mushrooming encampments? This is a professional, coordinated, well-resourced, highly planned out effort by organizations, left-wing organizations working hand-in-hand with Islamist organizations. And it is worth doing the follow the money analysis there and connecting the dots for the American people about who's behind this. And last but not least, again, emphasizing the point that there's a direct link between the policies you see from the Biden administration and where these kids are on these campuses now. We just have the graduated, buttoned up versions of the pro-Hamasniks at the State Department and elsewhere in our government today, and they are already dictating policy. So there's a clear national security threat at the end of the day as a consequence of these schools being hotbeds of anti-American, violent, pro-genocidal jihadist activists.
Well, on that note, we'll transition to Inez and Title IX.
Yeah, so I gave the update last week about how massive a change these Title IX regulations are, and I'll just go over the three major bases on which they, completely rewrite American federal law and challenge court precedent on key constitutional rights like due process and the First Amendment, right? So first of all, the most obvious change this makes is it incorporates gender identity into the definition of discrimination on the basis of sex, right? We know that Bostock, that's Title VII, a different part of the Civil Rights Act. This is Title IX. That Bostock kind of gave the green light for this, even though I would argue that the reading of Bostock, like what Gorsuch actually said in Bostock, is very, very different than what the Biden administration is doing here. And it can be distinguished on a number of grounds, starting with the fact that it's a different title and there are different exceptions and applications of that title. So I think it's distinguishable. Nevertheless, so we would be wrong to not note that Gorsuch opened the door to this both in federal courts and now for the Biden administration to do it administratively with the Bostock decision. But this is an incorporation of gender identity into the definition of sex, which means that every school from kindergarten all the way up through law school, grad school, everything else that gets a dime of federal money, which is for the most part public and private, not treating a student as the gender identity he or she identifies as, is a discrimination that's forbidden by American civil rights law and all that that entails. And the school potentially is going to lose funding over that. And you can imagine that this is, massively impactful and changes a lot about the way that most schools are currently operating. Now, of course, we have, schools that have been doing things like this, like letting boys into girls' locker rooms, letting boys compete on girls' sports teams because they identify as female. All those things, sharing bathrooms with girls already, we know, and I think we covered on this podcast, that has led, unfortunately, to a number of sexual assaults, right? Just because the opportunity exists in private spaces that were once single sex. So all of that is the consequence, is now demanded by the Biden administration from every educational institution that takes any money. So massive consequences, potentially punishment of students who don't go along with this, right? Because the school has to, quote unquote, has to protect against discrimination. So there are potentially ramifications, for example, for some of the brave girls who have decided not to compete against boys. They just, they tap out, they forfeit their competitions, their athletic competitions, when they're being put up against males. Well, under this law, potentially the school has to treat that as, and to give some kind of punishment and to discourage that kind of behavior, because it would be encouraging discrimination, right? If it allowed that behavior to continue. If an eighth grader, like the case that we had, I believe in either Michigan or Wisconsin, I can't recall, maybe 6 to 9 months ago, if you have an eighth grader who refuses to use the preferred pronouns of another eighth grader, that eighth grader is potentially someone that needs to be punished by the school and his behavior discouraged, because that would be the school turning a blind eye to discrimination. So that's how massive these consequences are. The Biden administration is currently saying it doesn't apply to sports, and they're carving out sports for a later rulemaking. That's pure political theater. That's not what's happening in the courts. And the Biden administration has already said in federal court, even before they formalized this rule, that their view is that the state of West Virginia has a law that, I know this sounds absolutely crazy, but the state of West Virginia has a law that women's sports are for females only. The federal government has already filed a brief in the Fourth Circuit saying that that is in a violation of federal law, specifically Title IX. So they're already acting as though it includes sports. So it's just a pure political fig leaf, the end run around including sports in this. So that's just one huge piece of it. There are due process implications. We're going back to the kangaroo court era under Obama, where if you are a student accused of sexual misconduct, you have no right to an impartial investigator. You have no right to representation. In many cases, you don't even know walking into the hearing what specifically you're being accused of, like as in on Friday at 11 p.m., you're accused of doing X, Y, Z. It could be as vague as you're accused of sexual misconduct, and you find out when you walk into the room, because all they're required to get under these regulations is a summary of the charges. And then there are massive First Amendment implications. I already mentioned some of them with the pronouns game, but there are others. This returns to the Obama administration's unconstitutionally vague definition of harassment, which sweeps in offensive speech, right? So this is a massive regulation. It's well beyond the power of agencies to rewrite the law in this way. If you wanted to incorporate gender identity into American civil rights law, they have a bill for that. It's called the Equality Act. It failed multiple times in Congress, right? So we are suing. The Independent Women's Law Center is suing alongside Alabama, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina. No doubt that other states will sue as well. Louisiana is saying they will not comply with this. So there is some state pushback, along with Speech First, the groups, and Parents Defending Education, because there are parental rights concerns as well in all of this. We're suing on both an administrative grounds and on constitutional grounds that they don't have the right to do this. That's just kind of the update of what's going on with these massive regulations. Otherwise, we're hoping that the court will stay the regulations until the litigation is complete. Otherwise, these regulations will be in effect on August 1st. So for the next school year, upcoming school year, these regulations will be in force. So yeah, we're hoping that courts will at least freeze that until this litigation plays out. But we'll see. I'll keep you updated on that lawsuit and curious what everyone thinks.
It's impossible to underscore how unpopular this is with the general public too. When the Title IX proposed regulations were announced, they received, I think it was close to a record number or an insanely high number of comments of parents and organizations and individuals across the United States voicing their disdain for this move, specifically because of the men and women that it harms. So when I hear this, I ask myself, who benefits from this and who's harmed from this? So at face value, it's very clear that women are primarily harmed by this, particularly in the realm of sports. IWF has done an excellent job pointing out that over 913 trophies have been stolen from women in athletic competitions, with men competing as a woman in their place. So this means loss of potential scholarships, loss of titles, loss of advancement opportunities. So this is devastating for women who are using sports or are part of sports for various reasons. But on the other hand, when you have these sort of sexual harassment, sexual abuse allegations, moving back to the kangaroo court of Obama's time, this is clearly going to disadvantage men more than anyone else, who will have the Me Too movement take its third stand to really, take down the patriarchy, however you want to frame it. But men are the ones who are going to be disproportionately accused of things. When in many cases, right, women just find out they're unhappy with that consensual, was it not consensual sexual encounter they had. So really at the end of the day, this seems like a move that's made to pit the sexes against each other. It's tearing down both women, it's tearing down both men and making them see the other as increasingly the enemy here. So that sort of cultural chaos, that sort of tension between the sexes is only going to add to this sort of cultural difficulty that we're seeing worldwide, right? And so who wins from this? It's universities, it's these elite leaders. And that seems like one of the biggest concerns.
I think it's very astute to talk about, you know, what to what end, and the notion of pitting the sexes against each other. And obviously this is sort of the left's tactic, is they try to pit every single possible identity group they can against every other identity group, starting with the identity politics paradigm that they seek to impose and instill in people's minds in the first place. And then also, obviously, there's the idea of pitting kids against their parents, certainly an aspect of this as well. But I do think there is the question of, and maybe this is even the more disturbing thing, set aside the demerits of the policy, the illegality, the immorality, the disastrous consequences of, by executive fiat, seeking to impose essentially radical gender ideology in kangaroo courts and the like, and pit people against each other. What does it say that in theory, you probably have millions more people who, if they were aware of the ramifications of the regulations, would be up in arms and appalled about it and might even vote against Biden and others to the extent they supported these sorts of policies? What does it say that Democrats don't seem to be afraid of it? So the question is, did the administration make the calculation, well, we got to impose this basically in our last year, get it on the books? If a Republican gets elected, it's going to take them time to fight it and get it off the books. In the meantime, we're rewarding our progressive activists' ascendant base. But do they think that that trumps essentially potentially outraging millions and millions of Americans whose votes really matter, including in purple suburban districts? It's a scary thought to think that they view the benefits as outweighing the cost, or that they will pay no cost for this. And that's a really disturbing implication of the fact that these regulations are now in the books in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it's yet another instance of luxury beliefs. I read Rob Henderson's book on, and this is one of his big ideas, that the wealthy and especially elite Democrats believe things that they wouldn't tolerate for their own children or their own friends. And I see that now throughout, like, most of our politics. Like, the Democrats are the party of luxury beliefs, and there's no bigger luxury belief than this, signaling their status and their enlightenment while women get crushed underfoot and young men are wrongly accused. It's truly appalling. But with that, we'll move to the next topic, which is Ben on the speech police striking back.
Yeah, so for some more appalling news, I don't know that we've really talked about kind of the continuing onslaught, global onslaught against X and Elon Musk from the leaders in Brazil, where they have a Supreme Court justice there who seemingly has total power and forced X to silence Bolsonaro supporters and then threatened to hold Elon Musk in contempt for not going along with their policies. That's one piece of lawfare that's ongoing at a global level against X, which I view as sort of a stand-in for or a proxy for kind of the relatively digitally free digital public square being under assault, and that the globalist leaders nationwide who claim to be against misdis and malinformation, they feel they need to destroy X or kind of launder essentially the censorship regime through global actors to ultimately crush our speech at home. And I think that's a tactic that the censorship regime definitely wants to employ in 2024. Also, the so-called e-safety commissioner in Australia has sought to impose essentially global censorship over X by forcing it and other platforms to not only purge a video and among other content, but a video of a stabbing at, I believe, a church by a Muslim teenager in Australia, preventing not only Australians from being able to access the footage. And this, despite the fact that I believe the church leader who was stabbed himself says the video should be out there, but he gets no say. But also the eSafety Commissioner wants the video barred everywhere. So in other words, censorship of content globally that the Australian censorship leadership deems to be beyond the pale. I think it's clear that this is part of a much broader onslaught, not only against X, but also a way to use global actors to quell speech they don't like. And it's worth noting also that the Biden administration has talked explicitly with Lula in Brazil about the shared interest in combating disinformation, as well as coordinated with Australia and other governments to talk about essentially employing global anti-disinformation structures and frameworks, or at least codifying kind of the guidelines that all of these governments believe in when it comes to censorship, but which they cast, of course, as trying to prevent harmful misdis and malinformation. Now, back here at home, recently over the last week, we got news that the self-described Mary Poppins of disinformation herself, Nina Jankowicz, is back on the scene. Viewers will remember that Jankowicz was to head up the quote-unquote disinformation governance board, which was to coordinate essentially all censorship activities across the federal government and the national security apparatus to be housed in DHS. Of course, they characterized this as combating harmful foreign threats to our minds. And this ultimately under scrutiny fell apart, but Jankowicz is back with something called the American Sunlight Project, which is a 501c4 headed up by herself and essentially a bunch of other former left-wing partisans. They'll, of course, attack that characterization. There's one member of the board there who worked on Republican campaigns at one point and then was a staffer for Facebook. So they claim that they're a bipartisan 501c4 that's dedicated to countering those of us who have tried to expose the censorship industrial complex and work through legislation and litigation and advocacy to ultimately dismantle it. They have stood up this organization and said that those opponents of the censorship regime are actually neo-McCarthyites and that we are engaged in an attack on free expression and academic freedom against these helpless academic researchers on campus who are the ones who were surveilling en masse social media and working with the social media companies and the federal government to devise the policies to justify censoring and to successfully censor arguably millions of Americans, as a district court in Louisiana and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals found, on matters that are clearly protected political speech, ranging from election integrity to COVID and well beyond. So this organization was set up, first of all, to attack conservative members of Congress who are actually doing oversight work on the censorship industrial complex. It includes, according to an interview that I listened to, so you don't have to, with Jankowicz recently, opposition researchers and others engaged in open source research to essentially go after, and I think engage in hatchet jobs ultimately aimed at destroying first the politicians and then the others. She talks about, she characterizes those who are in the sort of counter disinformation, or rather counter censorship industrial complex space. They say in their website, Since April 2022, extremists have been running a campaign to undermine critical disinformation research ahead of the 2024 election and beyond, encompassing elected officials, conservative media, attorneys, paid-for journalists, and online influencers. The campaign has falsely claimed the federal government is overseeing a vast censorship regime in coordination with social media platforms, academic institutions, and civil society organizations, which is exactly what the courts found. So she disputes that, I guess. She goes on to say that basically those of us who have challenged the censorship efforts have relied are engaging in widespread smears against individual researchers and government employees, which have harmed them essentially or led to threats against their lives. And thus we should be shut up for exposing the censorship operations they've engaged in, and that they are somehow the victims, despite the fact that the court seemed to be pretty compelled based on the voluminous evidence to show that there was this coordinated effort, public-private effort, to censor wrong thinkers. I think this is a significant development. They apparently have raised over $1 million from donors that they refuse to name, despite the fact that they claim they want to be open and transparent about their work. Jankiewicz and the others here, it includes like Ben Wittes, for example, of Lawfare, others who were Emily Horn, I believe, who was associated with the Biden National Security Council. This should be viewed as one way in which the regime is fighting back, because the work to expose the censorship industrial complex has been effective. They are livid about the fact that those efforts have been exposed and that they've had to engage in litigation around them. And so consequently, this is part of a backlash and I think an effort to try and go at and basically personally destroy and professionally destroy, probably, a la what we've seen with lawyers defending Trump via the 65 Project. This should be viewed as an analog to that, I believe. So I think it's worth raising to, first of all, public attention that this group is out there and it's going to be aggressive, it seems. And this is notable in the run-up to the 2024 election, because I think this is actually probably about chilling efforts to expose the censorship regime and scrutinize it in the run-up to the election. So with that, I put it out to the group, you know, what do you make of Nina Jankiewicz's reemergence and the counter-censorship industrial complex push that seems to be mushrooming?
Yeah, just two brief points. One, when Nina Jankiewicz first came on the scene, I think those of us here were kind of two minds when the Ministry of Truth, basically, I can't remember what they formally called it, but whatever agency she was supposed to head, was folded because of public backlash, because we knew that all the people involved and all the programs involved were going to continue, just not under a single heading that gave Ministry of Truth vibes. So that turns out largely to be true. And my only brief other point is that courts really need to catch up to the structure of tyranny in the 21st century. We see some glimmers of it in those early Missouri decisions, but much less of it at the Supreme Court, right? It is going to require a rethink of in the way that every major, you know, sort of challenge or era has created challenges to the constitutional order. We need a way to preserve not just the letter, but the spirit of freedom of speech and the First Amendment in the United States in face of this kind of collusion between government and non-government actors, between international actors. We need our courts to recognize the reality of that blob and how it works together and how it coordinates. Whereas right now, I think too many people in the legal space and judges and lawyers are thinking about this in a way that's sort of technically on paper a bunch of separate actors making separate decisions. And that way of looking at the world is just not reflecting the reality of how this kind of power is applied in order to censor people. So it's something that we desperately need courts to catch up on.
Yeah, so hopping in here, this makes me think every single time of Rod Dreher's Live Not by Lies book that came out, I think in early 2021, and is perhaps just one of the best looks at the influence of soft totalitarianism on a society. So we often think of hard totalitarianism of the 20th century, right? Of these like obvious governments who were censoring your speech, censoring every aspect of life in a very despotic and unfriendly way, right? And And it's very different now, where you see the soft totalitarianism really manipulating the natural desires of people, and particularly this being so powerful through social media itself. So I think it's interesting that the times when people get really frustrated about their free speech, it's when they're censored online. And so on the one hand, this is the new public square where we all debate and discuss things, and it's incredibly important. On the other hand, I think most of America is scrolling itself to death and using itself to death, in the words of Postman. And so the moment they feel that their leisure time, that their distraction online is somehow, messed up by these free speech concerns, that's when you really start to see people get frustrated. But my concern is that as they become perhaps more sophisticated in their approach, using courts in this very divisive way, that you'll have more and more people who just don't realize the way that this, that their free speech is being limited, that this soft totalitarianism is really shaping every aspect of their life, whether or not they recognize it, whether or not that's obvious online or not.
Yeah, I just got to say how grateful I am that Elon Musk owns Twitter. And it's one of the few major heroic things anybody's done to protect free speech. It puts a, you know, I'm trying to imagine where we would be given all this activity outside of that. And we'd be in a much worse place. You know, I work for the Internet Accountability Project, and as well as the Article 3 Project. And they used to be Internet Accountability was where my primary focus was. But once Elon bought Twitter, my focus shifted to Article 3, because in many ways it was a problem that was massively mitigated in impact because of Elon's purchases. That's not to say there aren't gonna be a lot of problems going forward, but we really should be thankful for Elon. Next, we are finally moving on to Emma and Trump and DeSantis burying the hatchet.
Yeah, so Trump and DeSantis seem to be burying the political hatchet that they've had against one another for a very long time. So the presidential candidate Trump and former presidential candidate Governor Ron DeSantis met early on Sunday morning for multiple hours to discuss the future of their working relationship. So a mutual friend who is a major fundraiser, particularly with DeSantis, brokered this meeting in Florida. And so we've seen really two primary things come from this, the impact of this going forward, I think. The first is that as we near the election in 2024, it's clear that Trump is trying to shore up his support in the Republican Party. He's healing relationships that he sees as useful for him going forward, and is trying to get voters together, at least in some way, in a single Republican ticket and drive. So certainly having DeSantis on board works really well for Trump. On the other hand, this is also very beneficial for DeSantis as he eyes a 2028 presidential run, as well as for the rest of his efforts in Florida. The Trump campaign still seems to be rather brutally opposed to DeSantis, but I think it's undeniable to say that he is incredibly important for Trump going forward. And so this kind of leads into the second major factor here, is that Trump needs all the fundraising support that he can get. And DeSantis has a massive fun list of patrons who have been very generous and very supportive, both in his work in Florida and in his presidential run. So I think there's certainly a hope by Trump and his campaign that this will lead to a boost in their fundraising efforts, and a coalition effort across the GOP. So those seem to be the primary motivations going forward. I am very curious if there's any possibility of a Trump-DeSantis ticket. It seems highly unlikely given the Trump campaign's long relationship with DeSantis. But as I think about it, that seems like one of the most formidable combinations that you could possibly have, between Trump and DeSantis, preparing DeSantis for 2028, and also having someone who's just perhaps one of the most politically savvy people that we have had in office. Pairing those two together seems like it would be a no-brainer for lots of Republicans. But a few final things on this. We see Trump attacking RFK and really pitting him as a threat to the Republican Party, framing him as a massive leftist, and hopefully, I think, trying to get more Democrats to vote for him to weaken Biden. It's notable Trump has not reached out to Haley. It doesn't seem like he has much of a reason to do so. There's not much benefit he can gain from that, but is really focusing on DeSantis, which I think speaks well of DeSantis and also his future political future here in the GOP. But I'm excited to hear what you guys think on this and what your theories are about what they talked about in that meeting.
I guess I'll go ahead here, since I've actually worked for Governor DeSantis on his campaign. I'm thrilled to see that they're cooperating. I've actually thought this was a long time coming. In the aftermath of DeSantis withdrawing from the campaign, there continued to be some sniping, mostly from the Trump people, but also from some DeSantis people as well. And I just thought that was incredibly counterproductive on both ends. Trump doesn't need to alienate. There are a lot of DeSantis supporters out there, not enough to win in the primary, but plenty of votes you don't want to lose. These are natural Republicans, people that should vote for your candidate, maybe didn't in this instance. So I think it was just a natural thing, a good thing for them to do. And I'm glad to see it happening. I'm also just relieved to see that Trump realizes, you know, okay, it's time to work and actually be serious about winning, because, you know, he needs to win. The guy's facing criminal prosecution if he doesn't. And it's a very, very important, both for Republicans, but for Trump personally, to see them, they cooperate. And I think it's good for DeSantis too. It was a bad thing for him to have a leader of the party and a very popular leader of the party, a bad insulting. So I think DeSantis would make an excellent president someday. And I hope that he goes forward and does that.
I think there's always acrimony in hard fought campaigns like this, but you have to have a short term memory you have to have a long term memory, but also be short term focused as well and opportunistic. And it's obvious, it's a no brainer for the two sides to come together and put all of their resources together, all of their brain power together, and strategic acumen to try and win in 2024. So, you know, I think it's in terms of what was the conversation, I'm sure there was some genuine, probably burying of the hatchets of the dissension between Trump and DeSantis. But then also, I'm sure that money and support was a huge part of it and what that support will look like. And it'd be interesting to see if DeSantis is out on the campaign trail at all on Donald Trump's behalf, if he speaks for him as a surrogate in any sort of way, hugely beneficial to the Republican effort going forward. Whether or not you would have that Trump-DeSantis ticket, obviously anyone's guess. I do think it would be kind of hilarious in some ways if you did have that ticket, if then you have Trump running as a New Jersey representative, my home state, which would make probably many New Jerseyans aghast. But then also there's a contingent out there of New Jerseyans who actually are kind of the core Trump voter. So that'd be a fascinating thing to witness. But this is all to the good, I think, for coming together and trying to win in 2024. And for both the long-term prospects for DeSantis and the short-term for winning this election, it seems to me as if it's a political win and a win on the merits all around.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned New Jersey, Ben, because the first question I had was, how can they both run? Obviously, DeSantis is tied to Florida as governor. And then Trump, I would think, he really doesn't want to become a resident of New York right now, like for litigation reasons. I didn't realize he also had the option of becoming a resident in New Jersey. I imagine he has many Trump towers all in different states. So maybe he has many options, but I was thinking about how he wouldn't want to become a full-time resident of New York State anytime soon. But yeah, I mean, look, it's good that they're burying the hatchet. There are some things I'm not willing. I didn't work for anybody during the campaign. I would have voted for DeSantis if the primary had, you know, stretched out, and full disclosure. I mean, I really support the DeSantis agenda. But I understand that people, you know, get mad at each other during campaigns and they say horrible things to each other. The things that I'm not willing to forgive, that I'm going to remember and keep as sort of warnings on certain politicians, were the attacks on key pieces of the DeSantis agenda as opposed to DeSantis, right? I'm not going to forget that there were a whole lot of Republicans who came out and criticized the fact that DeSantis put in important sort of restrictions on curriculum with regard to what was taught around the period of slavery. Like, I read those. I read, you know, I read a lot of what was in the curriculum. It was American history. It was accurate American history. There was no covering over of the sin of slavery in that. And to me, like, following along with the left's attacks that it's illegitimate somehow for a state to care about what kind of hatred is being taught in the public schools. I mean, that to me crossed the line. Like, you can't attack stuff like that. You can't just repeat the lines of the left because you don't want this guy or that guy to be president. And I'm going to remember the people who did that, frankly. I don't trust them. In terms of the Veep stakes, I don't know. Like, as long as it's not Kristi Noem, I think she executed her possibilities as VP in the last week with that dog story about cricket. But you know, overall, it's a good thing. It does show that Trump is still interested in shoring up his conservative support in the base, which I think one of the indications of his remarks on abortion and IVF is I thought that he's really aiming only for moderates and he's not concerned about those to his right. And that could carry over into his administration, right? In terms of which constituents he's trying to please, like who's he's listening to, who's in his ear in terms of policy. And I think this is a really good sign that, you know, conservatives will have a strong voice in a potential second Trump administration. So that's also the good.
I think that's everybody, right? Okay, that's everybody. I guess now we're moving on to final thoughts. And since I don't have one on the top of my head, I'll leave that to the group.
I'll kick off and just briefly talk about the travesty that's going on in New York, just south of where I am right now, which is the Alvin Bragg case. Andy McCarthy has really put forth some exceptional analysis to show how in every way you have a judge who is playing judge, jury, and executioner here in the trial that he's overseeing and what he's permitting to be brought into evidence. This theory that there was some conspiracy to interfere with the 2016 election with this Frankenstein's monster of a case to begin with, where you take a misdemeanor where the statutes of limitation are gone, if it even is a misdemeanor, falsifying business records, quote unquote, here, and how you classify some payments in business records, and then bootstrapping it to concealing some kind of underlying crime, which is a federal crime, not a state crime. And Alvin Bragg doesn't even tell you what that crime is in the indictments. Just so many layers of utter insanity associated with this, on top of the judge, of course, being hostile as well. And this really is the death of the rule of law that we're witnessing. And it's amazing to some extent that we're almost unfazed by it and desensitized to it at this point, but something has truly been lost and you can't put the genie back in the bottle. And as much as we talk about Rubicon crossing here, it can't be overstated how significant what we're witnessing actually is when you have these conjured up out of thin air indictments that Bragg himself didn't even want to bring because he knew that it was a joke, and he gets forced into it essentially by a colleague who goes public demanding that he do so. And you bring the case in the middle of an election that's never been brought before on a theory that's never been tested before. It's just so outrageous and galling on so many levels. And again, the important thing to emphasize is that the rule of law is lost for all of us. It's not just that these are one-offs in the middle of an election. And I do think a question that ought to be raised is, you know, there's a lot of teeth gnashing about tit for tat and concern about engaging in tit for tat. And, you know, how we define that is obviously a question, and what can be done to deter these sorts of acts going forward, you know, understanding that already the precedent has now been set. A question that I do think is going to come down the road, because conservatives have not yet shown themselves to be open to engage in anything like what the left has engaged in, or at least with the seriousness and the shrewdness and you know, how pervasive and systematic they are in their assault on their political opponents. But I think a question is going to become, is tit for tat worse, or is fear-mongering about the consequences of tit for tat but not actually doing anything ultimately more disastrous? And I do think that is potentially where we're going to end up, because I don't see anything remotely like what the left is engaging in coming out of the right. And maybe you say that's a good thing, that's a moral thing, that's a just thing. But on the other hand, if the country dies, if it's not an eye for an eye and we all go blind, but it's actually just both of your eyes are taken out and the other side is stomping on your grave, is that something that we want to abide in this country? And I think, I'm not sure what percentage of the public is at the point of understanding that that is where we are headed. But it certainly seems like that's where we're headed. So I'd leave everyone with the question of, is tit for tat worse, and a world that none of us want to live in or none of us would have ever wanted to abide? Is that an unacceptable answer, or is it even worse to not have tit for tat and just be run over roughshod and dominated with tyranny, essentially? Two very bad potential options but I don't really see it going the other way and somehow there being a massive reformation when it comes to a left that has totally thrown to the wind laws, norms, rules, and principles that have kept this the greatest country in the history of mankind for almost 250 years.
Yeah, you know, these aren't principles that are even specific to the United States. As we've talked about a few times in this context, right, one of the reasons that Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon is because otherwise he was going to lose his immunity to indictment. It is not a good incentive for the peaceful transfer of power if the outgoing administration is open to lawfare and political persecution and legal prosecution. And I don't really know how to go about fixing it. I think it's pretty likely that charges against Biden will be pursued in his corruption case that is currently being, you know, fake walked by the DOJ if there is a change of power in the White House. I think that's probably necessary to Ben's point. It's worth pointing out, I mean, I don't really have a good solution. There isn't a really good solution for this. It's worth pointing out that even Donald Trump, the man famously, who is not a circumspect individual often and shoots from the hip and makes impulsive decisions and says impulsive things, did not lock Hillary Clinton up, even though he probably had the grounds to do it. Because even he realized that that would set a very, very bad precedent for the country. Well, for better or for worse, but obviously for worse, that precedent has been set. I don't know that there's any way to unring that. And especially given the target-rich environment in the Biden family, I would be surprised if there weren't going to be prosecutions. Now, maybe it's, you know, they prosecute Trump and then they come out and then Trump comes after Biden and maybe it's an exchange of an eye for an eye, but I think it's more likely that we see this just become part of our politics in a banana republic style way. Unfortunately, it's very, very difficult to build those norms back up. I mean, I don't want to be hopeless about it, but I don't really see a way to discourage people. Maybe we do have somebody who comes in after both of these guys and does the, you know, Ford pardon Nixon thing, just comes in, pardons everybody. And we get to start afresh and with a renewed reminder of how dangerous it is to break this kind of norm. But that seems wildly optimistic from this vantage point. In terms of just my final thought briefly, Ben mentioned, why does the Biden administration feel like they can do this Title IX stuff that is wildly unpopular? I think Emma mentioned as well how unpopular this is with voters. This is unpopular with moderate voters. This is unpopular with a lot of Democrats. This is a winning issue for the right and for the Republican Party. Why they have to do it now? It actually is largely because the Trump administration did something administratively right, which you don't often hear me say, but the Trump administration really professionally executed their changes on Title IX, their regulatory changes, set those in APA stone, as it were. And otherwise, we'd be having this on day one. The Biden administration wanted to put some distance between elections and this, but they weren't able to do it because of the administrative actions that the Trump administration had taken. So this really is sort of a W for Betsy DeVos. It's a W for the Trump administration for doing this the right way, crossing the T's, dotting the I's administratively, so that it puts Biden in the position of doing this right before the election, because I really don't think they wanted to do this. I mean, of course, they could drop the whole idea, right, and leave it to a potential second term. Their activists weren't happy to let that stand. So they had to do it in this term. They felt they had to give that activist the bone. And because of the way that the Trump administration went about doing their jobs, they had to do it before the election. And it is, I hope, going to become an election issue. Now, the press is trying to blunt that, right? There was even, so this, these regs dropped on a Friday. None of the Sunday shows that weekend mentioned Title IX at all, even though this has more impact than, like I said, than most laws passed by Congress, right? So none of the shows even mentioned this at all. There's been very little coverage in the mainstream media. I mean, a few articles here or there, you know, page 3, page 4, and it's already out of the news. I mean, independent media has done a really good job covering this, including here, but Megyn Kelly, others, but I think the strategy is don't talk about it. I think that's going to get a lot harder if this actually does become implemented on August 1st, because we're going to start seeing changes in the schools and parents are going to start seeing the changes in the schools. Students and universities are going to start seeing changes in the schools. So I would expect this to pop back up if courts don't stay it on August 1st. If courts do stay it, it may not be as great an election issue, but I mean, still, we don't want this disaster to be implemented. So that's kind of the landmark of the political map going forward on Title IX, I think.
Yeah, and I think this just highlights a massive underlying problem, is that we're no longer ruled by the legislative. We're not even really ruled by the executive branch. We are solely, or at least an increasingly amount, we are ruled by judicial court decisions. They are the ones who make final calls on every law, on every presidential action. And so for the most part now, right, like, what's our one rejoinder when we don't like a regulation that's introduced, when we don't like a bill that's introduced? We say it will never stand in the courts. The courts will have our back. This is the way to go. And I think it's incredibly dangerous, as I think this entire conversation underscores how much we've really ceded so much of our political power, policymaking power, the power of approval to the judicial branch, really abdicating the original and intended roles of both the legislature and the executive branch. So I think we've really set ourselves up for this position, hoping the courts will be, you know, the one governing force between the political power of the Democrats. And I just don't think that that's at all reliable. The framers didn't think this is reliable, which is why we had the system of checks and balances initially established. But I'm really concerned to see so much of American political life simply move to the courts. That's an incredibly weak way to govern a nation. I do have some hope for the Supreme Court case regarding presidential immunity. I think that's so contrary to everything I just said, I do still have some hope about this case, that there could be a really strong precedent put forward governing presidential immunity. It seems likely that President Trump will gain immunity from at least some, if not all, things. But I think it would be very useful when it does come to holding President Biden accountable and future presidents for the obvious and egregious abuses that they've had. And then I think my final thought really goes back to the Hamas protests on campus. And one of the things that I just think is hilarious and really sad about this entire movement is this movement that claims to be very progressive, very pro the minority, is really just a regression back to a very primitive form of being. And really, anytime you see Islam take over, you see the society, the culture, the rights of the people regress significantly. So look at the majority of female protesters on campus, and in many cases, they are majority female, and they're all wearing head coverings. They're all wearing masks or these like public muzzles, right? They're doing the very things they criticize Reform Christianity of doing, which is, you know, forcing women to cover their heads and, you know, not allowed to speak in church, not allowed to speak in public. And yeah, that's exactly what we see happening with these pro Hamas protests. And so I think it's just like it's just a loss across the board for the rich culture, the rich educational environment, and even like the proper promotion of men and women in this healthy debate with one another. And instead, we're just seeing this ugly promotion of head coverings, homeless people not showering in these like gross encampments, and women wearing masks, men wearing masks and like really covering themselves. So it just seems like a clearly regressive step, not good for civilization. It's part and parcel with the progressive movement.
Yeah, my final thought, news just came up that Columbia's response to all the drama on their campus, yesterday there was a break-in into one of their buildings and people trying to hold a hostage. Their response is to say today that press are no longer allowed on Columbia's campus because, of course, press, it's very hard to keep press safe. Now, Jewish students might well be very unsafe on Columbia's campus, but they are very, very concerned about the safety of journalists who might report on what's happening on Columbia's campus. If anything, it's a full straight on alliance between the Columbia University administration and the encampment they're nominally fighting, because both sides seem to agree that it would be really nice if people didn't report on what they were doing or only reported on it in the way that they most genuinely approve of. These people deserve each other. I think that's the only real answer here. The Columbia administration absolutely deserves to have this encampment gain squatters' rights on its territory. And eventually, I think ultimately we need to return the university to its original function, which was as a mental institution. And with that, I think we're finished for today. On behalf of Emma, Ben, and Inez, thanks for tuning in. I'm Will Chamberlain. See you at the next NatCon Squad.